Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June the 13th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Ingrid Christiansen, who will be talking on writing our stories. Let's listen in.
My name is Ingrid Christiansen, and the title of this session is, and that's always the one that I don't know the answer to, but it's something about writing our stories under the rubric, the general rubric of "We are the stories we tell." And I should confess that the overarching theme for my sessions this week is "We are the stories we tell," and I stole it from this book, which is titled "We are the stories we tell," which is a wonderful book. It's just a group book of short stories, but I think the point of it is an important point, which is that we really are the stories we tell. That story for us, when we tell the stories of what happens to us in our lives, we're helped by that process. It's almost an urge we have. He just asked me, "Are your children musical?" My children are arriving on the bus this noon. And my immediate temptation was to tell him a story about my children. So I'm going to tell that story now so that you learn something about what I mean by the importance of telling story in our lives to help us understand our experience. My 17-year-old son will get off the bus. He has long hair, blonde. He's gone through, in the last 4 years, having purple and green and pink and red hair, and now he's blonde again. He's returned.
You sure have come blonde.
No, I'm not. And my daughter, who's 19, may come God knows what color. I said to her a week ago, "What color are you going to come as?" And she said, "I don't know, Mom. We'll see." So, but he, my son, has been the drummer in a rock band. And so drummers in rock bands have a certain persona that they have to have. And so that's the purple hair, etc. Then he went from being the drummer in a rock band to playing in an African drumming circle, which is bongas and congos, and which I thought was better. I viewed that as important. And that's a drumming circle, and there were both boys and girls in it, and it was a kind of a nice circular experience. And he liked that a lot. Now, however, his mother has died and gone to heaven because his drumming skills have gone to playing the hammer dulcimer. So he's not only gotten rid of his green hair, but he's playing the hammer dulcimer. So that tells you a lot about his growth over these last 3 years. And so that would be the end of my story. That would tell you not only has the hair started blonde, gone through the colors and gone back to blonde, but he started being the drummer in a rock band. He went through African drumming circles and now is a hammer dulcimer player. And that tells you this boy is getting mature, right? He's starting to grow up. Stories are, I have some notes here that I want to follow because I wrote them out just for this. There. Stories are ancient. They're myths. They're legends. They're the way people have always communicated. They used to be the only way people kept records was by passing stories down. That I think they're the oldest form. Stories are in the Bible, all over the place. You know, in the beginning, the Bible says, or as it was told, or here's a story in 8 sentences that tells, it's a novel in 8 sentences. It tells so much. It's in John 12. It frames up. It does all the things stories does. It begins with framing up. It tells us, in this case, the frame includes the time, the place, and the characters. And then it tells us some what happened. It refers to some deep history. It refers to the future. And then it sums. It comes to an end. So in 8 sentences, none of us could do it in 8 sentences, so don't think I'll hold you to that standard. 6 days before the Passover. Now, we don't know what, I mean, then you'd have to assume that your reader knew what the Passover was, or you'd have to, somewhere in the story, lay out what the Passover is. Jesus, who's our main character, came to Bethany, which is a place, and you could later go on and talk about the place in the story if you wanted, where Lazarus was. So then we need to find out about Lazarus. So this is all in the framing up of this story. Whom Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Oh my. I mean, even in one sentence, we've got a whole story. I want to know the story of Lazarus being raised from the dead. You know, if you were a reader, you think, oh. Or if you're hearing this the first time, imagine hearing this for the first time. What? Raised from the dead? There, meaning in Bethany, they made him a supper. So now we've come down to a very concrete, small bit of time, a manageable bit of time, which this story is going to be about. Martha served the supper, and Lazarus was one of those at the table with him. So this person who'd been raised from the dead was at the table for supper. Boy, this is a great story already. I mean, it's so rich with possibility. Mary took a pound of costly ointment of pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the ointment. So there's a sort of what happened in the story. That was the action, which is a pretty incredible action. Once you, I mean, if you imagine making a film of this, you know, filming this story. But, da-da-da-da, evil comes into the room. Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, parenthesis. Now, this author has really got us on this. A little tiny parenthesis. By the way, he who was to betray him. You know, sound the evil sounding, thunder in the distance, low notes on the piano. So, I mean, now we've got a little foreshadowing. So this is really some framing up, and it's telling us a story. It's telling us a story. There was a supper, they poured oil on Jesus' feet, and she washed his feet with her hair. But it's also referring to a much bigger story. Novels could be written about these eight sentences. Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, he who was to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" Self-righteous bad guy. "This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief." So now we're getting a little depth of knowledge about this character, Judas. "And as he had the money box, he used to take what was put into it." So now we found out this guy's really bad news. He's berating her, who was it, Martha, for washing Jesus' feet, because he wanted to steal the money. He wanted her to sell the oil and put it in the money box because he had the money box. This would be fun to film, actually, this whole story. Imagine the characters and the typecasting you could do. Jesus said, "Let her alone. Let her keep it for the day of my burial." Now, what's this about his burial? Here's a perfectly healthy middle-aged man, young man, really. I mean, from my point of view, I'm 52. He was, what, 32, 33? Sitting at the table having dinner. My burial? A little more foreshadowing there. "The poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me." Now, lots of us wish he'd never said that, because it's used for all sorts of evil purposes in our present world. But it ends up with that moral. It ends up with a kind of a moral statement. So in eight sentences, we've gotten a tremendous amount of information. So that's one story, but the Bible's full of them. Our lives are full of them. We tend to tell stories about things that are important to us, like births and deaths. Think of all the birth stories, especially if you've had a baby. When you tell that you've had a baby, if you're a woman especially, other women immediately start telling you their birth stories. When I was pregnant with my first child, I actually interviewed some women about their birth stories because I wanted to learn about birth. And it was fascinating. Women of a certain age told me their birth stories almost inevitably with tears. because the women of that age had been in a time when it was popular to give birth in bad ways. And so they remembered their births, or didn't remember their births often, in very tearful and sad ways. Other women have wonderful birth stories and death stories, and we tend not to talk about death in our culture enough, but when you do share death stories, they're wonderful. You learn so much. So, telling stories helps us understand our experience. It helps us to interpret our experience. If something's nagging at you, something that has happened to you is nagging at you, if you can tell the story to someone who loves you, someone who thinks well of you, someone whose assumptions about you are that you're a wonderful person, you tell the story in a way that helps you understand that you were a good person in that scene, that helps you understand even if you did bad things, you understand why. It helps you interpret your own behavior. If you feel bad about something you did and you tell that story to the person who thinks the best of you in the world, at the end of the telling, you feel some relief. You feel as though somebody else understands why you did what you did, and you can accept it in yourself better then. You can kind of, it's almost like we get an absolution from the telling of it. Remember the Ancient Mariner? The Ancient Mariner tells the story. He starts out his poem, The Ancient Mariner, by saying, I tell this every so often, I'm overcome with a desire to tell this story again. And he tells the story, and he feels terribly guilty, but then there's some kind of resolution that comes from him telling the story. Women who've had abortions often do this. They're fine, they go along, sometimes for months, and then suddenly they're overcome with the urge to tell the story again. And it's to expiate the pain, it's to get an absolution and a blessing, it's to come back to some rightness with yourself. So storytelling is very powerful. It's also, it's like lots of things, mystical things, you can tell, if you tell a story like that to someone who hates you, someone who thinks badly of you, I think you can do harm to yourself. I think you end up falling further into depression, hating yourself, not accepting yourself. So I really think that storytelling is powerful in our lives. We learn truth through it. A very famous sociologist that a friend of mine studied with one time said that gossip is sociology. Gossip is women's way, particularly, of doing sociology. But it's all in anybody who gossips, anybody who likes to talk about life. Sit, you know, put your feet up, get a cup of tea, and talk about life. Tell each other your stories. You're doing sociology. You're figuring out how to live. So we don't have to invent the wheel and reinvent the wheel and reinvent the wheel. We want to know from each other, how do we live? How do we get through this? And those of us who are Christians, I think, have a particularly rich heritage in this way, because our whole gospel is built on story. But we also have, I think, a rich opportunity to tell each other stories in which we can include the fact that we're Christians, the fact that we have faith. So it's really an important sort of a select audience to say, I can tell stories about the whole meaning of my life. I can include some of the deep stuff, some of the spiritual stuff. I don't have to edit my story as I'm telling it. So I think that's one of the gifts that I've, over the years, gotten from Holden Village, is that when we come here and we sit out on the rocks over there, or we go for walks up into the woods, we do tell each other our stories in much less edited ways than if I meet a friend in Chicago who's not necessarily someone who understands my faith. So that's one of the reasons I like to talk about story at Holden. Stories present paradigms. They demonstrate things. They sometimes are proof for things. You know, if I tell us, somebody will make a point, and someone else, even in sessions it often happens, somebody will make a point, somebody else will jump in and give a proof for a point that was just made with her story or his story. So we use story to prove things to each other. They give us some control over our lives. If something dreadful happens in my life, I tell the story over and over again until it gives me a sense of control over it, until I understand how to understand what happened. I understand the beginning of it and the middle of it and the end of it. Once I've packaged it up and told it as a story that has an ending, then I feel as though I can deal with it and go on. You know, one of my kids has a birth defect and some serious health problems, and the other one had to pay some consequences. And at one point, I had to tell the story over and over again of the dreadful day when we didn't pick her up at school, and it was winter time, and she went and played basketball at a neighboring school, and she got back to her school, and my husband and I were in the hospital with our other child, and it was a crisis, and we forgot her. And she was out, she stood outside the school in her basketball shorts in the winter time, and there was no one there for her. And she finally got on the bus, the public bus, and rode home, and the bus driver took off his jacket and gave it to her to put over her knees. He said, "Oh, you're cold." And she didn't know why we hadn't come. And she didn't understand. I mean, she assumed, I mean, she's a loved child, and she assumed that there was a good explanation. But she knew enough to get on the public bus and ride home. But then the end of my story, the thing that makes the anguish untie a little and relax, is that the bus driver took off his jacket and gave it to her, and she put it over her knees. And then she got home. I mean, there were many other things that I could have done that day if I just thought. I could have called a friend, a neighbor, any number of things. But I didn't, because we were in the hospital upset, and I forgot. And so now that I can, I've sort of packaged that story up. I've told it again and again, and I've finally come to the place where I've accepted it. I've accepted that I'm a good enough parent, that she is a loved child, that there was good in the universe. You know, the bus driver came through. So we do that. I mean, we do that about lots of things in our lives. Sometimes we tell these stories, and we learn from them where we're still hurting. We learn, like about that in that story, you can tell I'm not quite resolved with it. You know, that poor child, whenever I think of her standing outside the school in her little basketball shorts, not able to get in because the school was locked and her warm clothes were inside. So that story is a minor, little tiny story, but we find out by telling stories the places where our voice becomes uncertain. The place where we can't think of the right words, the place where we stammer. Even sitting with your best friend drinking tea in a quiet place, you know when you can't get through the story, you know the place where you're blocked. And those are important places. Those are places that's a gift, that you find that out. That's a place where you need to spend some more time. You and your friend need to go through it some more. You need to think about it some more. It isn't a good idea to keep those places inside. Those are the places that we do need to bring out and have our friends tell us, you're not a bad person. Because those are the places where we doubt ourselves. But there is evil in the universe, and there is pain in the universe, and there are terrible things that happen to us. And we need to be able to talk about those things. We don't want to bottle them up. And if we bottle them up, I think they do harm to us. So those places where our voice falters are places to pay attention to, and probably places where, if you're a writer, if you like to journal, you should do more writing. You should write about it in other ways. One of the nice things about writing stories is that you can write, you can put yourself into the same scene and cut it loose, cut the lines to reality, and let it float a little, make it crazier, change something in it. Change it so it's in a different country, it's in a different place, it's in a different century, it's in a different... Change something in it and write those same elements and the same characters in some new way. And sometimes you learn stuff that way. Stories are not tied to reality. My friend Linda Haugen uses the phrase, Linda and Marty Haugen are old Holden people. Marty Haugen wrote Vespers 86, 10 years ago, when they lived here. They have a wonderful phrase in their family, which is mythic heightening. And they, when children come in and are full of excitement about something and they exaggerate, or when we, mythic heightening is something of the ability to kind of depart from the truth while getting at a bigger truth. And I really favor doing that in stories. I don't feel as though our stories need to be confined to the absolute literal level, the absolute accurate truth. I think we sometimes learn more about ourselves and get more from our stories when we do a little mythic heightening. And in stories, of course, you can do outrageous heightening. You can not just do a little, you can do a lot. You can completely change things as long as you can still find your character in the story, find yourself or the person you're writing about in the story. It can be, I mean, people tell us sometimes that dreams are obviously stories. Sometimes they say that the characters in dreams are all parts of you. You know, that's at least one theory of understanding the importance of dreams in our lives. So if you have a dream in which there's a wolf and there's a lamb and there's, you know, two people fighting and two people making love or something, you know, those could all be parts of you. Well, in story, I think you can act out parts of you, too, or parts of the person you're fussing with, like if it's your mother or whoever it is. So I don't think it's necessary to keep story literal. But sometimes it's easier to start in the real world, in the literal place. I guess other things that stories do that are probably implied here are that they appeal to the wider community for commonplaces. The Bible does this a lot. There's sort of an appeal that this you will all understand. This will make sense to you. Or the values implied here are values that we all share. And I think that's good for communities, a sense that we all understand that, for example, coming through for your loved ones is important, and at some points challenging your loved ones is important. And there's some common sense there. I mean, stories do appeal to common sense. And we all have common sense. It might differ from one person to another, but we all have it. They teach a life skill. They illustrate a moral. So you understand all the things that stories do. I think that just in terms of a simple writing exercise today, I'm going to ask you to do a timed writing for 12 minutes. And I'm going to give you a sentence to start with. And then from that sentence, you will all take off in a whatever that sentence brings to mind. You will then move with it wherever you want. The story, I think, simply should begin with some kind of a frame, some kind of a setting up. I'm going to read you quickly the frames of a few stories here. Here's a Eudora Welty opening. They were strangers to each other, both fairly well strangers to the place, now seated side by side at a luncheon. A party combined in a free and easy way when the friends he and she were with recognized each other across Galators. So here we have two people who are strangers to each other and strangers to the place. Then that could go any number of directions, but she sets up that kind of a setting. So there's a lot of possibility there with all those, the strangeness of the place and the people. Here's another one, Tony Cade Bambara. Blind people got a hummin' Jones, if you notice, which is understandable completely once you've been around one and notice what no eyes will force you to see in people and get you past the first time, which seems to come out of nowhere. And it's like you in church again, with fat chest ladies and old gents grunting a hum low in the throat to whatever the preacher be saying. So blind people got a hummin' Jones, if you notice, is her first sentence. And she's sort of setting up, now obviously the story is going to include a blind person, and some stuff about black culture and church. But she doesn't feel the necessity to lay out a certain character to start with. But we do understand from her opening that she's wise. There's a sort of wisdom in the voice, in the narrator, in the character. Here's another one, Sandra Cisneros. Everybody in our family has different hair. Then she goes on, my papa's hair is like a broom, all up in the air. In me, my hair is lazy. It never obeys barrettes or bands. And she goes on about hair. Now, there's a way of getting into describing her family, and then she's going to tell a family story. And I suppose the hair will be sort of symbolic for the way they behave in the family. Louise Erdrich. The first time she drowned in the cold and glassy waters of Lake Turcot, Fleur Pelliger was only a girl. The first time she drowned. You know, so this story's got a little bit of spooky stuff in it, because this girl literally does drown twice. And survives both of them, incidentally. And here's one last one, Becky Bertha. Grace, come to me in my sleep last night. I feel somebody presence in the room with me. Then I catch the scent of Posner's bergamot pressing oil and that cocoa butter grease she used on her skin. I know she's standing at the bedside right over me, and then she call my name. So Grace come to me in my sleep last night. There's a character, we don't know what the relationship is between the two characters, but one is visiting the other in their sleep. So there are any number of ways to frame up or open a story. Then the middle, you lay out the details, you have something happen. That's where the story kind of unfolds. It's the literal level. A few stories can get away with nothing happening, just reflections, just kind of a person resolving something in their mind. In most stories, something happens, at least something. Like in this story in the Bible, Martha washed Jesus' feet with oil. That was what happened. The rest of it was reflection. In a story I read a couple days ago, there were 20 scenes of reflection and one scene where one thing happened. It was the last scene in the story. So, but in your story, I would recommend that it's easier to write a story where something happens. And then, at the end, endings can be as varied as beginnings, but they do often circle around and refer back in some kind of way to the beginning, and they resolve something. You know in your heart when you've told the end of your story. You know when you've got a good listener, when someone who loves you is listening to you talk, you know when you've finished the story, when it's become resolved. So sometimes it has a moral, sometimes it has a theme, sometimes it's a resolution, sometimes it's just the end of the action. And the action itself, you know, if the person's life is saved or the person dies, you know, I mean, there's some kind of resolution. Have any of you been in a class where we've written stories together before of mine? Okay, then I'm going to use my favorite opening. Anybody who needs paper now?
Yeah.
Okay, here's paper and pens, and I have to really make you promise to give back the pen if you take one, because they're going to be really mad upstairs if you don't. Can you pass some paper down?
Sure. And pen?
And pens.
Anybody else need a pen?
I need pens. I need paper, though.
I have paper.
And Tape Ministry, just let me give the writing assignment, and then you can shut off the tape for 12 minutes. The first sentence that I'm going to give you is a sentence that you don't have to use in your story, but it's a sentence that you can use as a trigger to help you think about what you want to write about. And I would recommend that you write about something familiar, somebody you love, somebody in your family, something that happened to you, someone you know, so that you're not making up, you're not starting assuming that you have to make up everything, fiction from the beginning. It'll end up being fiction, it'll end up being your story, and so you can do mythic heightening, but don't feel that you have to start by creating whole cloth, something brand new. You can write, I would prefer you to write a story about someone you know, yourself, someone in your family, something that's happened that you know about. The first sentence that you can choose to use or not use as you like is, when I was growing up, all our Sundays were just alike. So, when I was growing up, all our Sundays were just alike. Yeah, obviously you can hate him or love him or whatever. Okay, Tape Ministry, 12 minutes from now we'll pick up again. I'd like to know if anybody wants to share what they've written, share their story.
I'd be glad to, because I'm old enough that I don't get quite as embarrassed about revealing myself.
I don't know that that's a function of age, but read us what you've written.
Okay. When I was growing up, all our Sundays were just alike. Scary. That's when I began to make up a family and a world I didn't live in. So all... Let's see. To make up a family, and it's a wonder I didn't fall so far into that made-up world, but I never got back into the real, scary world that terrified me. My new father wasn't dying of cancer. He didn't depend on me to carefully wash his wasted body. I'd close my eyes when I got down under the stomach to those bloated swellings between his legs. Lymphoid cancer, I learned later. But enough of that. My new Sunday morning father, was he really my old, old Sunday father, remembered from far away beginning of a long tunnel? I can almost see down the dark center onto a long time ago. This new father was so handsome, tall and strong, and oh so kind and gentle. He put his head inside the door to my bedroom and say, "Hurry up, little one, time to rise and shine."
Oh, what a nice story. It's got some heaviness and intensity in it too. Anybody want to give her any feedback or comments on her story, quickly?
The connection with the suffering, but yet that you were able to move on. Assuming the story is true, I don't know if I'd say you've resolved
it. Yes, it was true.
Yes, that you've resolved it, but that it was a dying time for you with him, but you moved on, even as you said. I think you said, but enough for that, or enough said about that in your story.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with it is what I'd like to know.
Oh, no, we don't do that in these sessions. What's wrong with it? There's nothing wrong with it. It's a wonderful story. No,
connection.
One of the principles, I think, of story writing and telling in this kind of a session is that we can give each other positive feedback and, you know, feedback on content, but we don't critique each other's writing.
Okay.
Which I think is a much happier way to proceed and helpful, actually. Who else has a story they'd like to share? Okay.
When I was growing up, all our Sundays were just alike. "Who's going to church today?" echoed through the house. "People are up, but who's up?" I knew I would go, no question about it. Of the 7 people in and out of 1 bathroom, I knew for sure that I was going. Uncertain, unpredictable, last minute, excuses or silence, like waiting for puppets to declare their part. Ironically, we'd hear, "If you don't go to church, plan to spend the afternoon home. No movies, nothing." "This is a day of rest, you know." That's my mom. She's like the town crier lighting lamps at dusk. She announces how it is, or at least how it ought to be. Never did figure that out, as if choice about church really wasn't a choice, but a threat. Didn't exactly walk those 5 blocks by myself, clicking my heels. But then sitting in the first row balcony, wondering what would happen if I accidentally dropped my hymnal on the people below. Crack, smack, all looking up at that not-so-good little boy. Now that I could count on, and there was some relief in that. When it was that hot, muggy Minneapolis evening, and we couldn't sleep, we'd get in the car, all 7 sticking to each other, roll the windows down, and ride around in our pajamas. And from the space inside, from somewhere, would come the question, How was church today?
And what's your profession in life? Aren't you a pastor?
A pastor with a sense of humor. I love it.
That's great.
Yeah, that was lovely. And it was lovely the way you tied it up at the end. How was church today? You know, and the implied meaning and possibility and your role in the family then becomes teacher. And that was nicely done. Lovely. Who else has something to share? Okay, back there.
Gigi and I are sitting in her kitchen drinking coffee together as we always do when I come back home. Everything is so familiar, the smell of the coffee from the pot she has had forever, the sweet fragrance of dishes drying on the rack, the promise of plum jelly with our toast. It is always the same when I come home. Having coffee with Gigi used to be something I had to do. When I was in college, I'd come home a few times a year and had to make sure I spent some time with Gigi drinking coffee and eating toast with jelly. I didn't really enjoy doing this as I had so much to do, but I knew that Gigi enjoyed seeing me, and so I would sit with her for a respectful amount of time and then leave. And I didn't finish because I can tell you where I'm going, but through marriages and births and going home and enjoying these times with Gigi. Mm-hmm. And then the ending was going to be Gigi explaining her. When I was growing up, all our Sundays were just alike.
Mm-hmm. Keep writing.
I'm going to.
Yeah, it's really, I'm already really pulled into it, and I want to know more. And you're writing well, so keep it up. Good. Thank you. Next. Okay.
It was about 3:00 in the afternoon, and soon we would be getting ready for the every Sunday ritual activity. It wasn't that we went to church. As a family that I remember, it was that we went to Grandma's for dinner. Dinner was at 5:00, and it took a half an hour to get there to Grandma's house. My sister and I went to church in the morning. Mom never went with us. I don't know why. She just never did. Then at 3:00, we had to stop doing whatever. Maybe it wasn't at 3:00. Maybe it was a little later. Sandra, my sister, complained about having to go to Grandma's. And sometime, I don't know when, she just stopped coming. I remember the drive. It seemed to take forever. There were stoplights and a drainage ditch concrete lined that seemed to go a long ways there. Mm-hmm. When we got to Grandma's, my aunt would come for dinner and bring green jello salad with pineapple or carrots in it. It was always green, yet sometimes it was dark cherry jello with bean cherries. For dinner, it was always fried chicken and mashed potatoes and gravy, sometimes tomatoes with sugar. It was my job to help with anything. I remember being incredibly cherished and loved and adored at those Sunday dinners.
Interesting. I would not have predicted that last line. I had a little sense that there was something ominous in this. I think it was that concrete drainage ditch.
Green jello and carrots would do it for me.
How are we supposed to guess the state?
What state would you guess?
Well, Minnesota.
No, no. And I grew up in Southern California, and my...
Yes, uh-huh. Cherry jello with cherries in it.
Really?
Yes, yes.
And it wasn't until I went to South Dakota that I connected with my grandparents' connection with the Midwest.
Iowa.
Because I didn't pick up
Iowa.
The tomatoes. Yes.
Iowa.
Yes. Yes.
Tomatoes with sugar.
Tomatoes with sugar. And I never saw anybody in California do that. Except my relatives until I went to South Dakota.
Isn't that?
And I saw them do it.
Yeah, had to be
my relatives did the tomatoes with sugar too. But they were from Kansas farm people and they did it on the farm.
Mm-hmm. And those uses of detail are very wonderful in a story and really important. and can be used as effectively as you use them. That's really a good way to tell a story, is to use those precise details. Think of all the things you didn't tell us, but you did tell us stuff that already people here are talking about. So that was really good. Thank you. Okay, who's next? Okay.
The chores had to be done. There was limited activity. The milk rot went faster. The farmers all seemed to take less time to visit. They were off with their families for a day of activity. There were images that emerged, but there was none that was there was one that was consistent, always the same. At some point in the day, Sunday's men, a pot roast, brown potatoes, cooked carrots, and the family sitting down to what I would now call a celebrative feast. It wasn't celebrated then, it was simply darn good. Time has, on several occasions, placed me in homes with a pot roast cooking. It has transported me to Sunday noon. Often relatives would visit. Some of them were dressed up from church. They always got in trouble, especially the kids, for we would roughhouse in the barn and their parents were obsessed with their clothes. I guess a pot roast, brown potatoes, rolls freshly cooked, butter melting in the texture, the flaccid but tender carrots meant Sunday noon. It meant Sunday. Now, as a clergy person, the feasts now are much more varied. The surprises of guests, the value systems of visitors, and creative activities are just as aggressive. But Sundays are the same. It's fun to recall a gift.
Hmm. Nice.
Philosopher.
Yeah, right. So that was a story with lots of images, lots of concrete stuff, a real sense of how that youth has grown and mutated but become still part of the same thing as an adult, and nothing happens. It's a story that he is reflecting, he's talking about the meaning of his life, but he doesn't have an action in it, but somehow we know a lot about him just from the story. So that's really nicely done. It's a different style of writing a story, and it's really successful. And anybody else want to say anything to him before we go on? Okay, who's next? Thank you. Okay.
On Saturday nights, we took a bath. Each one of us kids, one after the other, in the same water, to save on the water and the heating of it. The house we lived in belonged to Grandma Dorothy, and my sister Kathy and I shared the upstairs bedroom across the hall from the small two-room apartment that was let out to roomers. Mrs. Doherty lived there for some years until she died, a sweet old lady who sometimes invited us in and gave us a piece of candy. Her apartment smelled of old ladies, that heavy, sweet, musky smell of a place that had not been aired out all winter. That heavy smell of silence with only a clock ticking away the long, warm, dry hours of a day in the life of an old person. She did tatting and she cooked her own meals, but I don't ever remember smelling them. I also don't remember spending much time in my bedroom. It was a place to sleep and dress. I wet the bed until I was 10 or 12, and I remember proudly announcing to Mrs. Doherty one day that I had not wet the bed. The bathroom was at the end of the upstairs hallway, and it was huge by modern standards. The toilet had a pull chain, and the tub had feet. And there was a lot of room for several people to be in there at the same time. There was a folding rack to hang laundry to dry in there. The window faced the driveway on our next-door neighbor's house and the chokecherry tree. I found myself just going through this house and just eventually I think I would have gotten to the driveway where that's what I remember about Sunday mornings is getting in the car to go to church. The driveway. But I don't know where I went. I just thought, oh, this is just...
Yeah, but your use of detail and description is wonderful. I mean, I was right in that house there with you.
Right.
So you should keep writing. All of you should. But I really want to know where you're going to go with that story.
I do, too.
And eventually you might get to one day that you would either make up or remember parts of and have something happen.
Yeah.
Have an event. Who else would like to read us a story? Okay, John.
When I was growing up, all my Sundays were just alike. I would awake early to be greeted by silence or by the sounds of my sleeping parents. When mother and father woke up, the sounds of their quiet talking would cross a short hallway to fall on my listening ears. I would lie quietly, without saying a word. When I grew tired, I began to make quiet, rhythmic noises by repeatedly but slowly moving the cage of my crib to make clicking sounds. Mm. or holding my breath and letting it push out. My sound making was methodical, and my intention being to attract attention by impinging upon my parents' awareness gradually. And that's as far as I go.
We have here a very wise little baby.
Well, I probably had my crib and daughters about 4 or 5.
Yeah. Well, we got that impression too, but that was interesting. You could have taken that into some kind of an ominous sense that you were encountering tempers.
Counting which?
Tempers.
Uh-huh.
That if you didn't very subtly, I mean, a child who's full of ego and no fear might just say, "Mom," you know, when they wake up, or cry or something. Right. But you were doing it, there was a reason, there was a method in your madness. Why did you do this? And that's what I want to know.
Yes,
why were you such a considerate child? So that's lovely. Anybody else have one? Okay, good.
I was gone for part of the time, so I didn't get to finish mine either.
Oh, you had to go put your clothes in the dryer.
Yes. When I was growing up, all our Sundays were just alike. The night before was always bath night to get us ready for Sunday. And then in the morning, we put on our special clothes to attend Sunday school. The singing and the stories were a highlight. During church, Mom and Dad led a choir. Usually one was one service and one had the other. Or sometimes my mother was the organist. One Sunday, a soloist in the anthem, during the anthem, wasn't so good. And I told her about it afterward. She slapped my cheek and said he had stepped in that morning to sub for someone else. So I learned to always find something good about a performance and keep my criticism to myself. Mm-hmm. And that's as far as I got.
That's a wonderful frame for a story, because then what goes on and happens can play with truth and honesty and lying and white lies and getting along and not. I mean, there's a lot of potential there.
I accompany kids in solo and ensemble now, and I always try to find something. This was very good, because they are so nervous and so upset that they think they did such a bad job. And no, you did this very well. So I learned something way back then.
Yeah. And you could write, that's a nice frame for writing a story about some particular case. Anne, do I see your hand going up back there?
Yeah. When I was growing up, all our Sundays were just alike. They were centered around the whole left when Dad went off to preach. It was hard to explain exactly what he did, even in the church group, which was our usual circle of friends. He didn't have his own church. He visited other churches, and not just in Chicago. He got on a train or a plane and went to Connecticut or Washington, D.C. or Florida. He might be gone 2 days or a whole week, but he was always gone on Sunday. I was 7 and loved nothing better than the radio and the back porch, each separately. The back porch was the place to sit and play while still being able to watch what was going on in the neighborhood. The back hall was where I could sit alone by the radio and listen to evening programs and immediately be far away from my family and worries. My mother was a champion worrier, and I was her confidant, especially when Dad traveled. During the week, I had the escape of school with its walk there and back. In the evenings, my time by the radio was considered mine. That's as far as I got.
Mm-hmm. Once again.
Yes, I love the way that you make it very clear that you did not want to be the company of your mother, nor should a child be. But that was wonderful to make that point so beautifully.
Yeah, you have the sense that there's a lot of richness there. There's a lot of depth and almost murky stuff that a story is emerging out of. It'll be fun to see where it goes. Keep writing. Well, I think it's time for us to end. Tomorrow I'm going to do a little work with telling story, not so much writing it, but thinking of a story, an incident, and telling it. And so if you want to come back, we'll tell some stories tomorrow.